If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/wondery. rocketmoney.com/wondery.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to a special edition of the Late Night with Seth Meyers podcast. 1 year ago, we released the very first episode of this podcast. And to commemorate, Seth Meyers and Late Night's producer Mike Shoemaker recorded a conversation looking back at the show. If you enjoy this episode, please tell your friends to listen to the show for free on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find your podcasts. Now, let's get to Seth Meyers and Mike Shoemaker.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Late Night Podcast. I'm Seth Meyers, and I'm sitting here with the producer of Late Night with Seth Meyers, one of my best friends in the world, Mike Shoemaker.
That's
Hi, Mike.
Me. Hi. Hi, buddy. How you doing?
I'm great. And
we're supposed to say this is Late Night Chats.
Yeah, this. Oh, okay, great.
Right?
This is Late Night Chats. Hi, buddy.
Hey.
Oh, yeah, we haven't done these. These are our...
I've listened to them, but
these are our favorite parts of the podcast to listen to.
Oh, yeah.
Which is our staff's.
It's our staff not thinking that we're listening to their private details. And
yeah.
They're like, oh, I did this thing wrong once. It's so great. They'd never tell us.
So a couple things. One, I would not have said yes to doing this job unless you agreed to do it with me. I want to establish for people who are listening how important our relationship is professionally. Right. We're also great personal friends, but I wouldn't have been able to come do a show like this without your help.
Yes.
You said yes so quickly.
No, because I remember at the time.
But you said it as if I couldn't have done it without you.
No, you couldn't have. it would have been hard.
It wouldn't have,
I couldn't have been divorced from it in any way in that sense, because anything that you done since we met,
yeah,
pretty much. Mm-hmm. I have been involved in, except a couple of movies that we should not mention. But everything else, like the Correspondents' Dinner or the ESPYs, I would always go on those. So I think that that there's an interdependence.
So we go back to the beginning, which is 2001. I get hired on SNL. You are one of the first people I meet with Steve Higgins, and we became very fast friends in our time at SNL.
Yes. I should say that like weeks after you were hired, because like you're hired and then it's like you're hired, start.
Yeah.
There's very little prep time at SNL.
I'm still angry about the fact, because it's now I feel like you could have, I was
that
at
that process could have happened early.
No. I was at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival summer 2001 and you made me come back to SNL on August 20th. I had to leave a show I was doing at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, and not to this day, SNL has never started on August 20th. That is a criminally early time.
Yes, but they start later now, because be aware, we had planned to shoot something. Your first thing ever was planned to shoot on September 11th.
Right.
So that's earlier than SNL does now.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
So that's like a normal 2 weeks notice for like a normal job.
For a normal job, that's right. All right, I'm sorry I complained and blamed you.
I'm sorry, Edinburgh, to you people who missed it. but really, a lot of the story of why we're friends is that immediately after we hired you, 9/11 happened, and we were all back in at SNL. And we were supposed to shoot something that day that got canceled, but I feel like it got moved to like the next day.
I
think it was probably shot on September 12th. What was it called?
It was
Preparation?
It was Preparation H Extreme. It was sort
for
of
like skateboarders.
Yeah, preparation H ad shot in the style of like Mountain Dew commercials.
Yes.
And so just remember where you were emotionally the day after September 11th, and then just think of us all in a skateboard park
in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
Like riding past
the whole
well, and the enormity of it, and then saying like, I guess we have to go to work and do this thing. And I feel like the night after or that night, we all went out because that was planned as well, as like a drinks to welcome the new staff or just to hang out to get to know people. And it again, in the wake of 9/11, it was. And so that's the first time I remember talking to you significantly at a place called The Gaff. I don't know if it's still called The Gaff, but it's still
Midtown,
there.
A Midtown Irish bar that was a place we used to go all the time in 2001. But you're right. It was already an intense time for everybody who starts at SNL and the first time you go out for drinks for people, and then for it to be happening with this other thing that everyone was experiencing so intensely.
Yeah.
And then pretty much from the jump, everything I ever wrote on the show, I would show you first.
Yes.
And let you look through it and give me notes.
Other people do that. No one keeps it going. They get tired of it.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Seth would come in and like there are other people who either make that choice or a mistake, depending on how they viewed it. But Seth would bring me every script, and because you thought that's what you were doing.
I thought your feedback was good, and it always made things better. But this went on to the place where you left. I'm jumping ahead, but you left in what, 2009 to go work on Late Night with Jimmy Fallon,
right?
And then you would still. I slept at the office on Tuesday night, writing nights. You would still come to my office at 8 in the morning.
On Wednesday, yeah.
With a bagel and a coffee.
Each of us. And then just serve some food.
And then while we ate our bagels and drank our coffee, you would read everything I'd written the night before.
Yeah, and we kept that going until you left.
Yeah, right up until the end. You also...
He needed me less by the end. He had gotten to be good at sketch writing, but we kept the facade.
But of the many things you did at SNL, one of them... Because you sort of had a hand in almost everything at that show, but you also sort of de facto ran Update.
Yes, I was like the executive producer of Update, godfather of Update.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was always a producer... Mike Sherr, Charlie Grandy, eventually Alex Basil, though not when I was there. But yes, I was from the time of Colin and then Tina and Jimmy, I was, you know, on Update.
I'm realizing now your story is too interesting to just rush by. So we tell this for everybody who's
listening.
The
story starts when I met Seth. No.
That's what I mean. Your story is actually better than this. Every quarter we have interns on our show.
Right.
And we always sit down and talk with our interns. And I personally find your story a lot more interesting than mine because there's something.
It takes place in another time. It's a period piece.
But I was an improviser in Chicago, like a lot of people who now are colleagues of mine. Like my path was one that is, there were no crazy left turns. Yours is full of left turns.
Yes. Yeah.
So you grew up in the Bronx.
I grew up in the Bronx. I went to school in the Bronx, went to high school, went to college in the Bronx. My first job, and after I graduated college, I worked college graduate in Macy's putting price tags on socks, like for a good year. Like really, just like not a good advertisement for a college degree. And then somehow I transferred those skills to working in from working in a stockroom at Macy's to working in a stockroom at CBS.
Yeah.
And I don't know how that worked, but it was great because that was a goal of mine, not all through college, but near the end. And then so I worked at CBS in the stockroom, driving a forklift and moving around like skids of paper. And then from there, after I finished that job, which was like an 8-to-4 job, I would go to the local newsroom and try and get work there. And I would get to freelance as a production assistant in the local newsroom. And then I eventually, after working those two jobs, eventually got a job there. And I was in news for, I don't know, 5 years. And then someone came to train who had worked at SNL previously. I said, oh, how do you get jobs there? And she gave me a name of someone. And at the time, they're going through a big change, and I got a job at SNL as a production assistant, which is like a script typist.
So I feel we have so many people who ask us, how do you get started? How do you get a foot in the door in show business? Very few of them would be interested if they knew the foot in the door was forklift driver.
Yeah. I was so old. I was 28 when I got to SNL, to the job that you should get like when you're graduating.
But, and I think this speaks to how you were different from other people at SNL, you had also worked like regular jobs.
Yes.
More than other people.
Right.
Classically do at a show like that.
Yes.
So you come in, and not to date you, but you are...
I'm 59.
So you started in 86, right?
Started in 86.
And so now the script PAs, who are one of the most essential parts of SNL, and especially for a writer who's turning in things late, and they are the ones who are formatting it, and they're catching your mistakes, and they're so wonderful.
And by the time you got there, they're formatting it. When I was there... things were exclusively written on yellow legal pads, and we would have to – and sloppily and without punctuation. And my first day was like, oh, here's church chat. And it was all written out by Dana in whatever – like not easy to read handwriting, not a period or a comma in it. And you had to take it and really like, oh, huh. And you'd have to imagine how he was saying it and make it look like a script. That, and I remember like early on like, oh – I have a this is great. Also, I have a little bit of control here. Like, I can, like, pause, like, dot, 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 Satan, capitalize, because none of that was in there. So that was the most fun part to me.
My read on you, you are not an egomaniac, but you love a little bit of control.
I'm a secret egomaniac.
Yeah.
And I not secretly love a lot of control. Yeah.
I think one of the keys to our friendship is that I enjoy... listening to you.
Yeah. Seth likes being Roman recently asked, like, oh, you were like a mentor to him? I said, yeah, but it's a two-way street. I told him what to do, and he did it. If he hadn't, he'd be in the, you know, ash heap of history with many others.
So then you're a script PA. How do you make the jump? What is the
slowly?
Yeah.
And then I was like, at the time it was called film research, because it probably was film, or you would go to Tower Video and get VHS tapes of things. And then
and just to explain what that was is, as a when I was a cast member, you would say, oh, I want to do a Hugh Grant impression this week, and you would just go to the person who had that job then and say, "You need to get me a Hugh Grant movie."
Right.
And so someone would go to like Tower Records.
Yes,
and
we
get
would
you
go.
A
we would go and buy
DVD of Four Weddings and a Funeral.
Yeah. Exactly.
And I will. I don't want to name names, but I remember Chris Kattan would say, literally, would use that as like a slush fund.
Oh yeah.
He would say things like, "I might want to do a Beatles sketch. Go get me all the Beatles CDs."
So many people would just would want like box sets of things and like. All right. If you like them, you would do it.
Yeah. So then you do that job. Then,
one of the anniversary shows happening, the 15th anniversary, and then somehow that translated to helping pick clips for the, you know. So I spent a summer watching every episode of SNL from the beginning. And through that, I would like pick things. And I think then I figured out who Lorne was and vice versa. And then I started working more like in the talent department I was and then basically becoming an associate producer and then just like controlling.
Right.
And then it became eventually what you met.
Mm-hmm. And you also became part of the update world with Colin Quinn.
Yes. Yeah. Because when Colin took over Update, it was like a Tuesday night of a show week. And NBC famously, from above, said that Norm McDonald couldn't do Update anymore. And Norm was still on staff. Colin was the next one chosen. And we had to pull together an Update staff. We didn't have one. So we had to make one up. And oddly enough, I said, like, I'll take whichever writers don't get something in this week. And one of them was Tina Fey. It was like her first year and a very odd time that she did not get something in. So I built an Update team then. And then I kind of godfathered Update for a couple of years and then a little less near the end of Colin. And then when Tina and Jimmy got it, I was close with both of them. So I was more specifically on that. And that continued through you and Amy.
And you were specifically close with Amy and I as well.
Yes.
You know, I think I always felt like Amy, Tina, Jimmy and I were all very close with you. And the closeness you had with Jimmy was why you left SNL to go work on his show.
Exactly. Yes. Like, I couldn't imagine him doing that show without me.
Yeah.
And subsequently, I couldn't imagine you doing this show without me. And therefore, that's how we did it.
It's so weird thinking back to that. I was really upset. I knew you were doing the right thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I was so worried about, like, what my life at SNL would be like without you there.
Yeah. Well, we, oddly enough, no one knows. The decision for Jimmy getting late night happened right around the time that there was a strike.
Yeah.
And the strike was the writer's strike was, you know, very long and very upsetting for all of us. Mm-hmm. You and Amy and I would meet for lunch just to, like, because it drove us so crazy that we weren't working together, and we wound up doing, like, a show at the UCB out of that. And through that time, things just started happening, I think, because the show wasn't happening. Usually the show takes over your life, but there was time to think. And then we came back. The strike was over. Came back and was announced we could do 4 shows in a row, which was a lot for SNL at the time. Mm-hmm. I think they do it more likely. But then it was a first. So I said to Seth, let's record ourselves every day. We did a video diary with that camera. And every day we would sit in the dressing room or in the office, say hi. And it was basically a message to our future selves to say, like, let's see how we get through these 4 weeks. Mm-hmm. And then we'll tell, like, who's fighting, how mad people get, or, like, how great it is, or how euphoric it is.
And it was always on a Wednesday morning.
No, we did it every day.
We did it every day for a month, or every day for...
Every day for a month.
Well, I know, because I recently moved, and I have the manila envelope full of the tapes.
Yes. I've saved them, and we're not allowed to look at them.
I have
a set, and you have a set. Deal is we're not allowed to look at them for another,
until
like 10
years. You die.
Until I die.
Or in 50. And we're hoping you have to make it 7 more years, and then we can watch it together. Yeah.
But anyway, in the decision for me to go to Jimmy happens in the middle of this. So it's not quite on camera, but there is one point where I said, well, we should talk about this thing that happened today. I decided we're going to go leave to do Jimmy. And we have it recorded. And we'll tell you guys in 7 years what it was like.
What it was like. And so then you left. You launched Late Night with Jimmy Fallon, which was a huge success, so much so that he took over The Tonight Show. And then you were kind enough to stick with the franchise for me. And it was weird because you and I knew, I think we would more than anybody, knew what my strengths were. But even with that, it took us a while to figure out what the strengths of the show were.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what I learned with Jimmy, besides everything about doing the Late Night franchise, was that it is about tailoring to the skills of the host. So, like, Jimmy's show, it was, you know, now it seems like a genre that everybody does it, but it was invented. You know, that's a thing that now many people do, and people think that, like, that's the kind of way people do it, but nobody did. So that was a show built around the strengths of the incredible talents of Jimmy Fallon. And then this was the same thing. We just had to figure out the best way to do it, and it took a while because your talents are like verbal acuity, and we didn't think we could pull it off right away. We didn't think we could pull off the volume of talking that you do on television now right away. And that, but we always knew that's what we wanted.
The other thing is, you know, the show obviously built into this thing where the crux of it now, I think we would both say, is the first act is very much about the news. You know, more often than not, you have a closer look. And we had to find the right kind of people to write those things, which we didn't start with.
Yes.
And we were incredibly lucky to find Sal Gentile.
Right.
So Sal, who is the head writer for the closer looks, this to me is, for those who are listening, this is the perfect example of Shoemaker's talents as a producer. Explain how you saw Sal Gentile and found him for our show.
In the wind-up for this show, there was a point where I had left Jimmy and I needed an office in the building because we were gearing up for Seth's show. We had not quite had this office space. So the office space that was available was adjacent to Alec Baldwin's MSNBC show. And I knew Alec, and those guys were very nice. So I happened to be in the office, and there were a few producers, and one of them was Sal, who I saw that he was an MSNBC guy. He knew news, and he would walk around, and he had almost every day a UCB sweatshirt on. So I said, oh, do you also do the UCB?
UCB, the improv theater UCB, here in New York, Amy Poehler started.
So I said, oh, he's a comedy guy who does news. And then while I was there, or maybe once we had stopped, that show ended, and I saw Sal on the 9th floor in the commissary, and I said, hey, you should come talk to me maybe about being a second producer. And he was like, oh, okay. And, like, he had barely an interview. I mean, it was handed to him, but I knew that he was like a normal person, and he was funny when I talked to him, and he clearly knew about news. So I said, oh, this is great. We'll have someone who can do – we always knew we wanted to have a lot of political guests. This will be our expert in that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how we have Sal. Sal didn't have to, like, he just like, huh, oh, job's gone. Oh, I got this one.
And then he was a segment producer, which is not a writing job.
Nope.
And yet you just have somebody like that around. And over the course of the first year, I think we both realized, oh, he should he can start helping.
Yes. He did say, like, oh, I would write this too. I'm like, oh, great. I mean, we knew the second producers do have to write things. So, like, it was clear that he could do it. But the extent to which he took it over is the jackpot of jackpots.
I think we've been very staffing shows like these are obviously very important. We're very lucky.
Yes.
We're coming up on 4 years. We have had, you know, so many of the people that we started with are still here.
Yeah. And the ones who aren't are, like, our friends. Like, they, like, we were very happy when Michelle Wolf said, oh, I think I can go to The Daily Show and
be a correspondent.
And we're like, great. We still text Michelle, like, once a week. Like all of those people, I feel that the people have left having enjoyed this experience.
Our goal is for people to leave for something bigger or the next step in their career.
Yeah. And if we have to help them do it, that's also, you know, that's what we want to do anyway.
And what would you say is our hiring philosophy?
Oh, do we have a philosophy?
I don't feel like we do. Because I feel like we're pretty knee-jerky.
Yeah.
In that we see somebody do one thing. Well, for example, Conor O'Malley.
Right.
Who is probably makes us laugh as hard as anyone.
Yes. But I believe that after we met Conor, I was like, oh, we're going to hire that crazy guy, right? Like,
yeah.
And it's more gut than anything.
Like, yeah. Like, Conor wasn't the kind of guy who blew us away in an interview in the classic, like, it's not like he read a book about interviews and how to, it was the opposite of that. But it was, I think we both knew, no one talks or thinks like this person, and you can never go wrong if you have that.
Yeah, Brian Donaldson. Similarly, I remember both those interviews being kind of close.
Yes,
chronologically, and Brian Donaldson, who was someone that Alex Bays found because he thought his Twitter was funny, and then and it was, and then we all looked. I said, "Oh yeah, this guy he thinks, you know, and he writes it really concisely," and we came in for the interview, and
we had just assumed because our head writer had found him via Twitter that he was a comedy writer living in New York.
Right.
And he said he was from Peoria, and we said, how long have you been living in New York? And he said, I just flew in from Peoria today. Yeah, and he was an IT guy at a company in Peoria, an insurance company.
That day he was.
Yeah.
And then we hired him, like, oh, I'm sorry, I can't buy these cables for you now. You have to get your own Ethernet cords. I'm leaving.
And Brian's still here. It's just fantastic.
Yeah. But that was also like a gut. Like, and I remember saying, we're going to hire that guy, right?
Mm-hmm.
oh, we're going to change that guy's life.
It's fun. The only disappointing thing when you're hiring is the limitations of slots.
Yes. Yeah. And it's great when you have a new show because you really can pick, like, you can put together, you know, it's like donuts. You really can say, like, two of these. Oh, my God, one of those. I can't have too many of those.
And we were really lucky because right when we were putting it together, SNL was having auditions for Black women. And so Amber Ruffin was all of a sudden in the building at a perfect time.
And
where
Seth had known Amber, worked with Amber at Boom Chicago.
And so sometimes it's that incredible good fortune of just somebody sort of passes in your field of vision when you're looking and you try to.
We had a lot of good and have since. All the secondary hires have been great.
The other thing which was, I remember us talking about, because there were a couple decisions our show made, but in the early days, and I feel like when our show started, you and I would both say, like, we had a very, I feel, and I don't think this is overpraising it because no one would think this is over compliment. Like, it was very competent.
Yes. That was, in retrospect, that was our problem, that we were so competent that people would love to have a Cinderella story. Like, they would love if something fell in the first show. And they say, like, oh, my God, they've improved so much.
Right.
Whereas we were competent.
It was, quietly competent.
Yes. But
I remember we used to talk about, because we would do political things, but maybe once a month.
Right.
And we enjoyed it. And we would say, oh, you know, but if we had to do them every day, like some of those other shows.
I remember saying, like, oh, my God, The Daily Show did not start doing those things. I can't imagine how long it took them.
Yeah.
You know, they had a whole, years and years and years before John even arrived. So I said, oh, I can't imagine we can put the staff that we have, which was based on the staff of Jimmy.
Yeah.
Like, I just got the same amount and I hired the same kind of people. I didn't think that we would get away with doing what we do. And we did, and the reason we did is because we built up to it and we got really good people and dedicated people. They take so much pride in it.
And I will say that was, if there was a departments that got bigger over the course of these 4 years were the departments that work on
yes.
A Closer Look.
Yeah.
Like we hired more graphic people. We hired more researchers. We hired, you know, people who check facts. And they really are, I mean, again, everybody who works on this show is incredibly dedicated, but it's really been fun to have these people who knew what they were getting into.
Yes. They saw it. Like a lot of them, like, had a few examples of it to say, like, oh, they're going to do this every day. All right.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's been really exciting.
How often do you say you and I are just in a room together and both looking at our phones?
All the time. Yeah. Pretty much when we don't want to talk to anybody else, we just act like it's a meeting and we just sit in a room and look at our phones and just, like, and once in a while, like, hey, did you see that and then something say, yeah. Oh, hey, why don't we watch that? Go on YouTube and watch like an old Forte sketch. That happens once a day. And a lot of our time is just like, just sitting quietly.
Yeah. I think it's a cause for great enjoyment in our staff when we fight, because we fight like a married couple.
Yeah. Well, I think because we always get along, but we do bicker about like stupid things, and then it's really funny for people to watch because, like, at first they kind of like it because it's almost always me yelling at you.
Yeah,
and then when it goes on too long, they're like, oh, I don't like it.
But I will. There's no residual. We never have a fight where it doesn't end with us laughing at one another.
No, we never. Yeah. I mean, every day ends. We say, bye, buddy. I love you. What was the last fight? Was me complaining that you kept getting, you had like a, was it an angel on your?
Oh, yeah. So,
an angel and a devil?
It was basically a trumpet where he was talking to the angel of devils on his shoulder. And you were...
I kept saying, you're looking in the monitor and you're moving your head in the opposite direction because the monitor's not a mirror, it's a monitor. And I said, so why don't we put it on cards? You're like, I'm going to be fine. I said, every one of our fights starts with you saying you don't need this. But
and
why
then,
don't we do it?
And then Shoemaker started saying, you know what? Do it your way and I'll just be sitting there watching you fail.
I'll just laugh. It'll be more fun for me to watch you get it wrong because Seth can see me. And when Seth flubs something, he imperceptibly looks over, and Sal and I, or Bays, or used to be when Michelle was here, we would just laugh. At
there is if the only laugh I hear is Shoemaker's, it means something has gone wrong.
Yeah,
and you're sort of the way I see you during the show is a silhouetted Muppet you just sort of shake
my shoulder shaking in delight.
I remember yesterday our monologue team comes in at 2 in the afternoon, like clockwork, because Alex Bays, our head writer, is a military
is
brat.
Is clockwork.
Yeah, he is literally clockwork.
Embodiment of clockwork.
He's the greatest joke writer on earth and the most punctual man on earth. Those are the two things about him. But the guest yesterday was Aya Cash from that show, You're the Worst. And I right before they came in, someone said, what show is she on? And they opened the door and you just said, You're the Worst. And everybody had just assumed you were saying it to me.
They were hoping, like, oh,
what did he do now? So it would not surprise anyone for you, the producer of this show, to be telling me, the host, that I'm the worst publicly in front of everyone. I think we have some questions from some people who like this kind of thing.
Glasses.
I should point out, because Shoemaker just put on his glasses, how many pairs of glasses do you have in the office?
Okay, so here's the thing. I buy inexpensive Costco-esque glasses, and I have a lot of them. I often have a pair on my eyes, one on my head, like an old man does, and then another one like in my...
Yes. And sometimes you'll forget that you have a pair in your head.
And I'll push it up and I'll knock the other one off down in the back and then I have to look for it. It's just a way to do it. They're not expensive. It's like
expensive.
Like,
no one's saying you're wasting money. People are saying you look like an old man with two pairs of heads of sunglasses.
That's not the by the way, that's not the only reason I look like an old man. I have 50 other physical things that really point out that fact. All right. Oh, put the glasses back on. Having seen the monologue rehearsal and the live show only a couple of hours later, I was wondering how you managed to incorporate news stories that develop in between rehearsal and taping.
So when we do a rehearsal at 4, where we read monologue jokes to an audience of people that PAs have just gathered up from the building. And as soon as we get through those...
Which is a thing that we invented for a Jimmy show.
Yeah.
Other shows don't do it. Don't start now, but I mean, like... It's so helpful.
Just even for 40 people, half of whom have never seen the show or know who I am...
Or speak English.
Yeah. But possibly. You just get a sense of what jokes work and what jokes don't. But as soon as the jokes part is over, and before we move on to rehearsing a closer look, all of the update... Sorry, not the update. The monologue writers walk out, and they write one last round of jokes. And we usually pull one or two from that last round just so we can be as current as possible.
Yeah. You know, like, there are times that we never thought there would be. Like, when these shows... any of the shows started, news never happened after 3 o'clock.
Yeah.
Like, that's not how the news cycle happens.
It's crazy.
You might all know now that that has changed.
Yes.
Hi, Seth. This is from Anna. I was wondering if you have any plans to write a book at some point in the future.
We've talked about this before. I don't find my story particularly interesting compared to other people that we've known who've written books. Like when I read Tina's or Amy's.
Those are great books.
They're really great books. Yeah. They have their stories are really interesting. I find them very engaging.
There's not enough adversity in yours.
No.
No. Like, you really, like, you like your parents.
I really like my parents.
There's no tragedy.
Like my wife.
Yeah. You're.
I'm good. I think with that said, I'd love to write a book. I like books enough to write them, but I just don't know if I'd want to write a memoir.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So get started on that.
Like a space opera.
Yeah. You know, do that. what happens from Indira? What happens when Seth gets sick? We just suffer through it.
Yeah. I've only missed one show for the birth of my son.
Right.
You can tell when I'm pushing through a cold.
I would say, like, in all of this time, there was only one show that is so obvious that, you know, it's helpful when you say it, like, because the audience doesn't think they're crazy. But there was only one show when it was like, oh, this is really bad. But mostly you just kind of have to, and adrenaline carries you.
Our offices are on the east side of 30 Rock.
Right, overlooking the skating rink.
The skating rink. And then our studio's on the other side of the building. And so I have an office on this side, and in the studio I have a little dressing room off the stage. And there have been a couple times where I've been so sick during the day that I've stayed in the dressing room and had people come to me because I'm like, basically, it's like
visiting grandma in the hospital.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. How important was moving away from the traditional standing monologue for the show's success, and where did that idea come from? Everybody.
Yeah, everybody did.
we got a lot of shit for it.
We really were stubborn about not wanting to do it. And
to the point of being like...
spiting our...
No, like when people would say it, nobody said it nicely.
Nobody said it nicely. That was the real issue.
That was really the problem.
And, you know, initially, we've talked about this before, we just didn't want to look like Update. And then the reality was Update wasn't a bad thing for... It wasn't a bad look for me. But it was
a
huge...
We gave it a good... What was it?
Year and a half that we
tried. Yeah, year and a half. So, like, there's a little sorbet of Seth's feet in between, but there's no...
Yeah, but it was great. I mean, it was a huge difference to sit down, just on a comfort level, and obviously comfort is a huge part of hosting these shows.
From Lauren, what has been your proudest...
From Lauren?
You know.
Oh, okay. From Lauren.
Maybe.
What time is the show on? Is it after Jimmy? Are you still doing it?
We're going to see Lauren later today.
Oh, we are going to see Lauren.
We have drinks with Lauren. We have a lot to fill them in on.
Yeah.
What has been your proudest moment on the show? That's a good question. I don't know what
question.
That is.
Look, it's a weird thing to say proud. We obviously thought the election was going to go another way. And so that night I realized, we have to talk about...
Just the fact that we were able to pivot.
I fully just wrote something on my own that we opened the show with the day after the election. And I guess, I don't know, it made me really happy to have a show more than maybe
proud.
Yeah,
it is very helpful because instead of just like retweeting someone that you agree with, you get to like actually
just speak.
Like that's what this does. It's super helpful for us. It's from Britta. What is the first thing you do when you get to the office? We usually...
We find each other and...
Yeah, our offices are next to each other.
Next to each other, yeah.
And I think we talk first.
We get in. And then, you know, when it moves on to the business of the show, Sal, by the time you get in, he's sent a draft of a closer look.
Right.
And then we just start working on that.
Yeah. Ben Warheit.
Ben Warheit is a writer on our show.
Yes.
You might know him as my nephew, Derek.
Yes.
He wrote some?
He's a beloved writer on our show. And so he has some questions, some very Ben
Gotcha. Questions. How many are there?
Three.
Okay, so this is how we're going to end.
This is like 3 days work.
Okay, so these are the last three questions of this podcast will be from our writer, Ben.
What do you think it would take to get them to turn down the super loud Christmas music that they play across the street for 3 months straight in front of Saks?
Yeah, it is problematic.
It is. We hear that Mariah Carey song. It loops around. They play a loop on this. Right above the skating rink.
Yep.
And above the tree and across from Saks. And I don't know if the music comes from Saks. I think it comes from the skating rink. So it's really right up our...
Yeah.
You hear Mariah Carey like every 30 minutes?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Jose Feliciano was like...
It gets better after Christmas because then it just turns into sort of a playlist and it's not as bad.
Yeah.
I will say, though, here's why I think they will not care that the writers want it to be turned down. One of our writers brought in a ventriloquist dummy.
Oh, yeah.
And another writer hung it like from a makeshift noose in the window.
It was like from the blind cord.
Yeah, they like a joke to this writer, which is, I hung your dummy.
Yes.
Someone immediately called security from another building.
Because someone was in New York to see the tree, looked up to the right, saw what looked like a lynched child in the window, and called security. And then people called me and said, what? Like, jerks.
It is when, it's nice, because it happens less than you think when comedy writers are exactly like comedy writers in fiction.
Just, yeah.
And do something that dumb.
Do something that dumb. Yes. The head go and say, hey, we can't have the dummy. And I don't, I mean, it sounds like I yell at them. I don't go around yelling at people.
No.
It's rare. They all laughed how funny it was that I came in and yelled at them about like hanging a dummy from the window. Which unaired Ben Warheit sketch would you want to see most in Second Chance Theater?
Unaired Ben Warheit sketch? Well, I think at some point we'll do... Ben is a kid talking about the news who just had his wisdom teeth out.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's really good.
Ben has great...
Yeah, we're big fans of Ben.
We are big fans. Those Derek things. And then we did something a week and a half ago, which was... which you could have seen on television, which was Ben wanting Seth to sit in the silence with him.
For a minute. Just be in the silence.
Yeah. And the amount of people came up to me and said, like, we're going to do that? And, like, even the day of the show, like, so... You're still like people who just want to catch my eye to see if I'm lying. And I'm
well,
like,
they, because you and I are great lovers of structure and premise and jokes, but we also have a real soft spot for that kind of thing too.
Yes.
And so I think that when we really like it, people can't tell if we're being sarcastic.
Also, whenever Ben does those kind of sketches, I always pull him aside and say like, when he does Derek too, I say, or anything really, I say, this is a good time for you to reach over and try and grab Seth's hand.
Because, he does. He always tries to grab my hand.
I love it when he tries to invade your space, and he does it really nicely. And there was one where he just like really managed. Usually you pull back enough because you see it and you recoil. But there's a couple times that he like latched onto you that it just made you squirm so much. And that's my favorite part of it. How do you think Ben Warheit was able to get a bachelor's degree in neuroscience?
Yeah, this is a true story about Ben. Our writer, Ben Warheit,
like most people think that they're surprised that, like, you know, he makes it here.
Yeah.
Because he portrays an innocent childlike ignorance.
Here's something that Ben will do once a year. Ben has, you know, those things, toothpicks that come in like a cylindrical container with a little hole so you shake one out. And he knows that I will, every time at his desk, I take a toothpick from him. And you sort of turn it upside down.
It's when Seth's in the writer's office, just kind of chatting.
Yeah, I'll just walk in.
So he's absentmindedly taking it.
But I'm also usually holding court.
So I'm
talking about something, and I go over and sort of absentmindedly take his toothpicks. And I turn it over to shake it out, and he's unscrewed the top. So they all come out, and he's also filming me as it happened. He's getting it on camera, and he just starts saying, what did you do? What did you do? And it makes me laugh harder than anything.
Great. Also, I would recommend anyone who wants to know more about Ben to check out his Instagram. I look it up. I think it's Ben Warheit. But he did 70 Post-it note size drawings of dicks.
Yeah.
That are pretty great.
He is gifted artistically.
Yes.
Yeah.
Very
this
much.
This is not, these are not graphic.
No.
These are very clever.
They're
again,
adorable
if you don't
ones.
Like any art.
Yeah, well, you know what it is, so pieces, you can either choose to see it or not.
Those are the kind of people we hired.
Yeah.
He's an outlier.
Ben is another one that Seth and I did a show called The Awesomes. It was a thing on Hulu. It's very popular.
Very popular. Hulu might bring it back.
Check it out. It's we did 30 episodes, and we met Ben as a writer on that, and we said, we have to get this delightful person to come here.
Yeah.
He was delightful.
We're very lucky. We're very lucky that we get to work with each other. Yep. We're very lucky we get to work with everybody else here. It's a very nice family. Feels like a family, doesn't it?
It does.
Yeah.
It does. It's like a family that we don't have to make them like, but it's also there. We have good distance in between.
We don't have to have dinner together.
Yeah.
All right. I love you, buddy.
All right. I love you, buddy.
Want more Late Night with Seth Meyers? Be sure to follow the handle at Late Night Seth on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. You can also watch full episodes of Late Night at LateNightSeth.com or on the NBC app. And please tell your friends who are fans of Seth Meyers to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.